Hi, my name is Hixie. I'm an alcoholic. Through God's grace, strong sponsorship, and the 12 Steps and Fellowships of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since June 4th, 1995, and for that I am eternally grateful. I don't know what you're going to get tonight. You know, we come into the program, they talk about halt. And when I got off the plane, I was hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. They've taken care of hungry. Being with this group has taken care of angry and lonely, but I am still very tired. I'd like to thank Bob and the specific group for having me here. It is such an honor and a privilege to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor named Polly P. I have a home group, and it is the Friday night Pickerington group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Pickerington, Ohio. We meet every Friday night at 8 o'clock. We have a couples meeting, an Al-Anon meeting, an AA meeting, and babysitting. If you want it, we've got it. I didn't fly from Ohio, though. I flew from Sedona, Arizona. So I drove 2 hours to the airport to Phoenix, hopped on the plane for a 45-minute plane ride, got off the plane, scared poor Bob to death because I got a ball cap on, my hair's all messed up, cargo shorts. And he says, "Do you need to change?" And the answer was, "Yes, I do." Because I was taught to respect Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was taught to dress up when I'm behind the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the thing that I have to ask myself every day is, if I'm following those traditions, am I an attractive member of Alcoholics Anonymous? Do I have something that you want in my life? Am I an expression of all that God is and all that you taught me to be? Or is it a bad day and I am just the best bad example that you have today? You didn't want to see me yesterday. You put two alcoholics in an airplane. You put a little problem of money, property, and prestige in between them. And that is a long 3.5-hour flight with no conversation. You have saved my life. I was never so grateful as to get on that plane in Phoenix and to come to this group. Because when I came to you, I came home. And when I came to you, I wasn't lonely anymore. And that's exactly how I felt the very first day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked in and I was so heartbroken. There was something in there that light wasn't touching anymore and that I could not drink away anymore. And I came to you, and I sat on my seat, and I cried for 2-3 years. Still crying, 10 years later. I didn't believe anything that you said. You talked to me about faith, and I nodded my head. And you talked to me about prayer, and I did it because you told me to do it. And I went to meeting after meeting after meeting because I didn't know what else to do. I loved Michael's talk. I want what he has. I don't want to be 10 years down the road and lose that gratitude for just waking up being sober today. And I can lose that in a heartbeat. When I get away from you, I forget. I forget what that's like. I have to come to you over and over again to maintain my sobriety. I am so grateful for you tonight. You have given me what I asked God for this morning, which was peace of mind. I asked God for miracles for other people. I very rarely ask for myself, and I said, "Hey, buddy, I need one for me today. Let me know that you're with me today." And he did, because there you are, and you are beautiful. You are my people. And I'm okay when I'm with you. Hopefully I'll stop crying pretty soon. you know, I don't have a racy story. I'm not under a bridge. Do I look like an alcoholic? Hey. You know, I am a soccer mom. I was a softball mom. I was married to this up-and-coming yuppie attorney, you know? But I am that woman. You know that woman it talks about in the big book? That women don't have to drink for very long before they're beyond all recall? Well, let me tell you, I am beyond all recall. My first drink's no big deal, you know? Just took a drink, third grade, no big deal. Did not black out, pass out, love it, and want to do it again. When I was in junior high school, I really didn't like the taste of booze. And I was running around with some kids that were smoking pot. And we get out of school, and I went to school in Sugar Grove, Ohio. The main street is, I used to think it was a mile long. And since I've started running, I realize it's maybe half a mile long. But we would get out of school, and we would race down the main street, climb down this bank under the suspension bridge, and get on the beam, the support beam under it, and we'd sit under that bridge, and we'd smoke doobies. And then, you know, we're just cool. And this is back in the whatevers. And dropping cigarettes and sunglasses down into the water, and we crawl out from under that bridge, and we go across the street, corners to the local drugstore, and I have the munchies, because that's what pot does to me. It makes me stupid and hungry. Got the munchies. So I'm drinking bottles of Mountain Dew, which was 25 cents a bottle then, if any of you remember that. Cigarettes were 40 cents a pack. I'm old, but anyway. So I'm drinking Mountain Dew, eating Conn's potato chips. I know you guys don't have those out here. And I'm just cool, but I don't like the taste of booze. A number of things that happened in my life. That year, my father died. He just got up in the middle of the night, and he was sick. And he went to the hospital, and he never came home. Now, while my father was doing that, I was out in the barn sinning with my boyfriend. And until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought it was my fault that my dad died. I thought that I was so bad that my father, or God, had taken my dad. And so I oscillated until I got to you of either trying to be really, really good to get to heaven, or being really, really bad to get to hell. And I can never be really, really good long enough, or I can never be really, really bad long enough. And I am not Catholic, but I think that's in-between thing was what purgatory must feel like, you know? You're caught between heaven and hell. And I like to tell my women, I don't care if you're male or female, but if you ride the fence long enough, you're gonna hurt. So I was hurting when I got to you. Anyway, my dad died, and I did booze, boys, and drugs within like 6 months. Now, people die all the time, but you don't do booze, boys, and drugs and crawl out the bedroom window and run away, you know, and do those kind of things. And I did that within 6 months, and my mother took a geographical cure, and she moved us to California. And I was out there, and I was really isolated from my friends. But you always told me that water rises to its own level, and sooner or later, I found somebody else who was smoking pot, and that's what I was doing at the time. So I'm about 18 years old, and I'm lying in this little dinky apartment in California, and I'm smoking this joint, being stupid, totally unmotivated, like pot makes me, you know, just laying there on the couch, and I had this thought, I cannot go to work and support myself smoking this pot. It just makes me stupid and lazy, and I don't want to get up off the couch. So I put down the joint, and then I picked up a drink. And I was never free of alcohol until I came to you. Now, I didn't immediately become a daily drinker. It was a gradual, slow thing. It was progressive, just like the book talks about. Marriages and babies will cure me for long periods of time. Depending on how long the marriage was, right? I am a multiple marrier. I have been married more than once and less than five times. I have been divorced more than once and less than five times. Bob suggested I might have a fiancé. I said something about my partner, and he said fiancé, and I'm thinking, I think recovery may be for me not getting married for a while. So marriages and babies will fix me for long periods of time. And I am attracted to the disease of alcohol in a man. I mean, even if he is a movie star, you know, if he's bad and he's got that seething soul of an alcoholic, that's the one I want. I don't want the normal nice guy that lives down the road. I want him. And I often say, if you put 100 guys in a room, they were 99 out of them normal, and one of them were an alcoholic, I would sniff him out like a heat-seeking missile, and that would be the one that I would fall in love with. So thank God I'm in the rooms of recovery. I'm still with my own kind. So I've been married more than once and less than five times, and I just married the disease of alcoholism over and over and over again. You know, my first marriage, I'm not drinking alcoholically, and I get hooked up with this guy, and I can't figure out why he doesn't drink. He doesn't drink. And then I saw him drink once, and it was bad. It was bad. So, you know, I married the second guy, and he's telling me about driving hundreds of miles, sleeping in a bathtub, going home, driving home, and always getting up and going to work, always getting up and going to work. Because if you go to work, you're not an alcoholic, right? Well, I didn't even know what an alcoholic was. I didn't know what alcoholism was, so I married this guy, and I end up with three children in the end of that. And I would wake up in the middle of the night, and I would pace the floor back and forth, just knowing that something was wrong. He wasn't a daily drinker. He was a periodic drinker. And I would put his dinner in the oven about 9 o'clock. And about 10 o'clock, I would get a little edgy. And about 11 o'clock, I was in full-blown anxiety. By midnight, every sound on the street was scaring me to death. I've got these three little kids in bed. And every time I heard a car, I just knew it was the police to come tell me he was dead. And he would roll in the door about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, dead drunk and smelling. And he'd wake up the next morning, go to work. He's a responsible alcoholic. And I would just wake up just as mad and just as hungover as if I had been the one that was out drinking the night before. I feel for the people that we affect in our lives because I remember those feelings today. Now, when it was my turn to drink and I was out in the bar and my next ex was out looking for me, I did not remember what it felt like to be the one left at home. I did not remember what it felt like to listen for the car. I did not remember what it felt like to feel the pain and the fear of having somebody you love out in the bar drinking. And you didn't know where they were. And I left this guy home with my three kids. They weren't even his kids. They were my three kids. We talk about an invisible line, and don't you think that's just so totally unfair? Because the problem with the invisible line is you don't know where it is. And I heard a speaker say once, you know, you don't know where the invisible line is, and once you've crossed it and you found out you've crossed it, it was way back there. I know the drink that was the drink for me. I know the drink. I made a decision to do something that I thought was against my morals, against everything that I was. And I made a decision to do it, and I was going to do it. But I could not do the deal until I went and got the bottle of wine and took the cork off and poured the first glass, and I downed it. It was like, I can do this deal now. I don't have to feel it. I can do it. And that was the drink. Because from then on, it was never about drinking pretty. It was never about controlling anything. It was about drinking. If I felt good, I drank. If I felt bad, I drank. If I thought I might feel bad, I drank. I drank when I anticipated the next party. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, drinking was like breathing to me. I'm a gourmet cook. I didn't know what protecting your supply was, and there was all this language to recovery that I had no idea about when I got here. I am a gourmet cook, and I would sit in my desk in my office, and at about noon I'd start thinking about what I was going to cook that night. And about 2 o'clock I'd just get a little jittery, and I'd go out and smoke a cigarette. And by 5 o'clock when I got off, the carryout was right between my house and the office, about 2-3 blocks, and my car would automatically turn in there. And I would buy whatever wine that I needed to cook with that night. Now, I don't know if you've ever cooked with wine or if you've ever read a recipe that cooks with wine, but you open the bottle and it says 1 cup of red wine, 1/2 a cup of white wine, you know. And every night I would go by the trash can and that whole bottle of wine would be gone. And every night I would tell myself, I'm not going to drink this whole bottle. I'm just going to use as much as I'm going to cook with. And every night I would go by and I would look at that trash can and that bottle would be in there. And I'd just kind of take my hand and just shove it just a little bit further into that trash so I didn't have to look at it. I have never been to jail yet. I've never had an OMVI. I had one speeding ticket once, however many years ago. I have been in a psych ward right before I got sober. What makes me an alcoholic? What qualifies me for the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous? I thank God every day that it's not quantity. I thank God that I didn't have to drink in the morning, drink round the clock for 20 years. It is not the quantity of alcohol that I drank that qualifies me for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's how I drank and when I drank and the way I feel that when I drink. And it's that I'm powerless over alcohol and I was drinking when I didn't want to be drinking. And it's that I couldn't stop drinking. And right before I got to AA, it's like, well, why would you want to stop drinking? Why would you want to be around somebody that didn't drink? And I now recognize that as, I've heard it said that if you don't think you're an alcoholic, what an alcoholic thinks like is, if I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. And what was I doing when I'm sitting at my desk? Thinking about cooking? I thought I was thinking about cooking. I'm not thinking about cooking. I'm thinking about drinking. And I got to you and you talked about triggers, and I couldn't sit at the dining room table and eat. I couldn't cook anymore. I ran myself into huge credit card debt, just maneuvering myself away from food and alcohol, food and alcohol, food and alcohol. And 6 months into my sobriety or more, I'm standing in Kroger's because there's just some things that it's real hard to cook without wine. And I'm standing in Kroger's and I'm looking and I'm reading the label on non-alcoholic bottles of wine. Now, if you haven't read a label, look at it real close, because it still has a very, very small percentage of alcohol in it. And people say, oh, it cooks out. And I think that's really great if you didn't cook to drink. But I would read that label, and I'm sober, and I'm wanting to cook and wanting to cook, and I'd read that label, and I did that for I don't know how long, of course not talking to my sponsor. And finally, after torturing myself with this long enough, early in my sobriety, I looked at it and I'm reading the label and reading the label and I'm thinking, you know, I would rather just eat meatloaf for the rest of my life than get drunk. And I had to put the bottle back on the shelf. So I drank long and hard for about 6 years, Yeah. Isn't that a short drinking career? And met a guy in a bar. And he didn't know what he was getting into, but he came from the disease of alcoholism in his family. You know, I used to drink with my mother-in-law, and she loved that. And I used to point my finger at her and say, she's an alcoholic, he's an alcoholic, they're an alcoholic, and I'm a victim. Oh, my God, if he just loved me more, I wouldn't drink. Or if he loved me the right way, I wouldn't drink. Or if he did this or they did that, I wouldn't drink. And I drank at that poor man for 6 years. For 6 years I drank at him. And I blamed him for everything. And I am a violent alcoholic. When I drink, I will break down the bathroom door to get at you. When I drink, I will fight you. I can remember one time. Now, I had underestimated the amount that he had drank, which is always a fatal error if you're in a drinking relationship. I just underestimated the amount that he drank, and I'm drunk. And we start fighting over whether the TV is going to be on or not in the living room. And the fight was on. And the fight was so bad that his brother and his cousin had to pull us apart. And I can remember that his brother had me on the floor with his knee across my chest. And his cousin had him pinned up against the wall so we would not kill ourselves. That's what I do when I take a drink. I don't dance on tables. I get ugly. And I developed all kinds of skills. I would break down the bathroom wall, and I would get up the next morning and I'd fix it. And I break down the bathroom wall and I get up the next morning and I'd fix it. You know, I knew how to plaster walls. I've been living with men that used to like to hit the walls. I knew how to do that. And, you know, nothing is wasted in God's world. Because even into my sobriety, I use that skill. You put a hole in a piece of drywall and wallpaper, and I can patch it. And I've had to do that in my sobriety. I haven't wanted to hurt anybody the way that I wanted to hurt that man when I was drinking since I've been sober. Michael talks about backhanding his mother. You know, I would not touch you like that. It's been a long time since I've even had that feeling come up inside of me. You know that feeling I'm talking about? The one that starts down in the pit of your stomach, and I just wanted to drink to make it stay down there. And I would drink and drink and drink to make that feeling stay down there. And all that ended up happening is the feeling came up, and the booze came up, and the feeling came up, and the booze came up, until I exploded. Somebody talks about it, about being a spring. Does Clancy talk about that, that emotional spring? And I can do that in sobriety. When I don't get to you and I do not talk to my sponsor and I don't get honest about what's going on with inside of me, and that spring goes down and that torque gets just a little bit tighter. You know, just a little bit tighter until I'm acting out all over somebody all over again. And I am sober. Or I haven't had a drink. Maybe I haven't been a meeting for, you know, 2-3 weeks. So, this is why I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada, talking to you tonight. Because I need a meeting bad. So, I did some crazy things. I did end up in a psych ward. I was in there because I was a victim. Not because I was an alcoholic. And I got put on the wrong floor. And I just kind of curled up in a ball for a while. And they gave me some really good drugs. And they let me out way too early. And I went home and I just drank again for a couple more months. And then there was the last drunk. And I got really drunk and I did some really stupid things. One of the things I did was I got my children up and I screamed at them and sent them to school. I drove across town drunk. I drove back home drunk, called off work, and I passed out on my couch. And I came to about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I could see myself. I could see myself laying on the couch, and I knew what I was. I could taste myself because I puked on myself, you know, and I hadn't cleaned up, so I'm a little crusty around the edges with that real thick tongue that you get, you know. Smell bad, look bad, felt bad. And I realized what I was. And what I was I was an unfit mother. That if anybody could have seen what I was doing, they would have taken my children away from me. It wasn't that I was beating them. I wasn't beating them. It wasn't that they weren't fed or they weren't clothed. It was that I was an unfit mother, that I was drinking, and I couldn't stop drinking. And that was my next thought. I've got to stop drinking. Got to stop drinking. And all my first step was, is God, I can't stop drinking. I cannot stop drinking. And I sit in a lot of step meetings and we headbang the first step. And you ever know, I don't know about around here, but back where I come from, if you do a step meeting, everybody comments about the first step. Everybody comments about the second step. Slows down just a touch on the third step. You get to the fourth step and you're about, you know, 40%. You get further down the steps and there's fewer and fewer comments. But we all like to talk about the first step, and I cannot give it to you. I sponsor a lot of women today. I've sponsored women that could not get sober. And I'd hear the same thing over and over again. I've got to do it this time. I'm going to try harder this time. I got to do it for my sick, dying mother. I've got to do it for my kids. I got to do it. I got to. And the first step says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Which for me means, no matter what I do, I have no power over alcohol. And you know what I'm listening for? I don't know what to do. I cannot stop drinking. I don't know what to do. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned that if I wanted to hear, I had to sit in the very front row. And I would do that. And I went to a Sunday morning breakfast meeting. And the room was maybe the size of this stage, and I wanted to sit in the front row, and there was only one table right in front of the podium, and I had to walk the length of the room, and I'm brand new, to get that front seat, but I wanted to hear. And I walked the front of the room, and I sat down in that seat, and I was sitting with a table of old men. They called it the Grandpa Old Men's Table. It was one of those long tables, sits about, I don't know, eight, two on the end and three down the sides. And I sat in that seat, and they all shook my hand. And they all said, hi, my name's so-and-so. Hi, my name's so-and-so. And I turned to the man on my left, and I looked at him, and I knew him. And he shook my hand, and he says, are you one of us now? And I said, yeah, I am. And where I knew him from was 17 years before, I was the waitress of the Sunday morning Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I used to serve them coffee and bagels and donuts 17 years earlier. And when I saw him 10 years ago now, when I saw him the first time 10 years ago, I looked at him, and you know what I was impressed by? I was impressed by me because I remembered him. I have enough time to know that I know what's impressive is. He has 26 years of sobriety today. And he had 17 years of sobriety when I sat down there beside him. And that was the big deal. It's not me. It was the 17 years of sobriety. And I used to get, you know, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 months and I become a meeting critic and a program critic. This is a good meeting. That's a good meeting. Blah, 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 blah. You know, and you sit in the back and you make care of old timers,
oh, I don't know what he's got or she's got. I'd rather drink than be like that, blah, 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 blah.
I don't consider myself an old timer, but I have 10 years of sobriety. And I want you to know that life has been in session for 10 years for me. I wake up thinking and feeling every morning. Every morning. I don't wake up thinking about drinking, but I got to address that thinking and I have to address those feelings every morning. I don't make fun of those old timers anymore, because if they have 27 years, 30 years of sobriety, that is 30 years of life without taking a drink. That is life, death, job, no money, good times, bad times, without taking a drink one day at a time. So about life being in session, I got real poor real quick. I was married to an attorney when I got sober. I did everything that they said not to do in the first year. I moved, got a divorce, had an early relationship, blah, blah, blah. I did everything you told me not to do, and I did everything you told me to do for the first year. And I stayed sober by the grace of God, because you told me to go to meeting after meeting after meeting. And when my butt was falling off and I didn't know what else to do, I would go to a meeting. And I work with new women and say, they just don't have time to go to a meeting. And I don't understand that, because when I was newly sober, I would sit there at my desk and I would watch the clock waiting. And it might be 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I would look at the clock and I would think, all right, I can make it until 7 o'clock. I don't think I could have made it to 7:05, but I could make it till 7 o'clock. I did not go to treatment. I just shook it out at my desk one day at a time, and I would sit there and I'd be typing, 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 typing. My mind would be racing, 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 racing. And you know what I'd be typing? Over and over and over again. God, please help me make it through one more minute. Please help me make it through one more minute. And I would type that over and over and over again until I get enough grace to get 5 minutes together to do another piece of work. And I'd look at the clock and I'd think, I can make it to 7 o'clock. And I'd go to the meeting early and I'd stay late. Not because my sponsor told me to, because the first 30 days I didn't have a sponsor. I just stand around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and eavesdrop on your conversations. You know? It's important how I act in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just as important is how do I act outside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You never, ever know who's watching you. So I'm eavesdropping on your conversations. You said, go early, stay late. I went early, stayed late. And I couldn't focus on the speaker because my mind was going, 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 going. And when I finally did get a sponsor and finally did share, gee, I can't listen to the speaker. She'd say, well, why don't you pray and ask God to help you focus? And I did. I'd have to sit there in my seat and ask God, please help me focus just for this 1 hour. And it was 1 hour during the day that I could live in my own skin. And it helped tear the meeting down. And I'd do it over and over and over again. That's what I did the first 2 years of my sobriety. I was not a good mother. I was not immediately emotionally and physically available to my children. I went to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting. If I could have seen what was to come down the road, you know, I don't know what I would have done. But I was grateful for having a foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous under me. I can remember being 6 months sober. I'm going through this divorce. Things are going on. And I'm dying inside. And I'm wanting to drink and not knowing I'm wanting to drink. You know, the disease of alcoholism talks to me. It doesn't always say, take a drink. He says, you know, my boss did not treat me right today. And then there's that ex-husband thing. And then there's that kid problem that's bothering me. And all this stuff gets going, 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 until it's so tight inside of me that I just want relief. And I'm an alcoholic. I know what'll give me relief. If I could just take a drink. If I could just go, ah, I don't think normal drinkers do that, do they? They don't drink a... And I made a phone call and asked for help, and this old man called me back 2 days later. And I'm laying there just wanting to drink. And he says, I can't help you, but I know somebody can. And he made a phone call. I'm in Lancaster, Ohio. He makes a phone call to Atlanta, Georgia, to a sober young woman in Atlanta, Georgia, who calls me back, who calls somebody in Columbus, Ohio, who becomes my sponsor for 30 days. And I am so dishonest in early sobriety. I cannot work with a sponsor that is 1 hour away from me. And she only sponsored me for 30 days. I now live in Ohio. My sponsor lives in Washington. So I made it through the first 2 years. And let me tell you what else has happened. I had to hit a bottom with sex and relationships that was more painful than anything I could ever remember when I was drinking. And I made that final commitment to stay alone and work on myself. And I did that for a while. And I changed sponsors until I got to Polly. So if you're going through sponsors, just don't drink and have a sponsor. I've never been without a sponsor. Even if I only kept her for 30 days, I've never been without a sponsor. And there I had a bad year. I had a son that was acting out. My mother's in a nursing home. They're calling me every other night, late at night. She's fallen. She's done this. You know, I'm taking my son to probation. I'm taking the other one to soccer practice. I looked at my day timer once, and I thought, oh, my God. You know, go here, go there, do this and do that. And I'm turning my will and life over to the care of God. And turn, you can, you know, for my mother, my son, and my other son, and all this stuff that's going on. I have a bad pap smear. That's scary. All this stuff is going on in my life, and I'm turning my will and my life over to the care of God. However, I do have a few ideas. And my ideas are my mother's going to stabilize, my wild child's going to straighten up. Everything's just going to be fine, as Pixie sees it. And what ended up happening was they called me one day at the office, and they talked to me about hospice, and I really didn't know what hospice was at that time. And, you know, they called me for a couple of days talking about hospice, and then they called me, and I could tell in their voice that something was really going on, and I said, do I need to come? And you know how the medical staff, they can be really wishy-washy because they don't want to alarm you. And they're like, well, you know, and I can get real hard when I'm scared. And I was scared. And I pushed her up against the wall. I said, do I need to come now or not? And she said, yeah, come now. You come now. And I got up from my desk and I went to my mother, who I had huge resentment against. I had huge resentment against God because of her. Or I blamed her for that. It really wasn't her fault. And I went to my mother, and because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the ninth step, I was able to be there with her. And she's like 89 years old. And she was just dying at old age, you know. She just couldn't breathe anymore. No big drama. She's just going out. It was her time. And she hadn't called me by name for years. But she knew my face. She knew that she knew me. And I went to her, and I got up on the bed with her, and I rocked her. And she was frightened. And I put my arms around her and I rocked her. And I found that she could calm down and be okay if I sang to her. And I sat on the bed and I rocked her. And the only songs that I could remember was Jesus Loves Me, Amazing Grace, How Great Thou Art. And that resentment against God went away. But when my mother died, I was clean. I was clean. You gave that to me. I lost custody. The one son lost custody. I gave custody back to his father because when I finally got honest with my sponsor, it was I could not give that child enough discipline to keep him out of jail until he was 18. But my pride was killing me. I'm the mother. I'm sober. I'm in recovery. I'm it. You know? To love is to have and to hold. And she started talking to me about surrender. And then the youngest one decided he wanted to go live with his stepdad. And that was a big one for me. And I did not want to let that youngest one go. And I couldn't understand because life was getting better. I had a little bit of money. We were having a little bit of fun, you know. But he still had problems with money, property, and prestige. And here's my ex-husband, and he's taking him to Hilton Head. And one day we're riding in the car, and I said, Danny, I don't understand it. For you to go live with him, you're going to have to tell that judge that I am an unfit mother. And that child narrowed his little slanted eyes at me. And he says, Mom, all I've ever wanted to do is go live with them, and I will do whatever it takes. And I dropped him off at soccer practice, and I went to a meeting. And I sat there in that meeting, and I cried, and I prayed, and I talked to my sponsor. And the only thing that came to me was, I'm not a religious person. But I do remember this. When Jesus is on the cross and he says, Father, forgive them because they know not what they do. And I couldn't let my son walk into the courtroom and lie because I knew he didn't know what he was doing. And I let him go. And I thought it was going to tear my heart out. And the pain was so bad that I never knew when it would hit me. I could be in the bathroom brushing my hair. And it would hit me right in the center of me and drive me to my knees. But you taught me how to pray. You taught me what to do. And I would call my sponsor and I would go in a meeting and I would sit and cry. And I would work with others. And every time a woman would come to me or any of you come to me and you tell me about the heartache, what it feels like not to be with your children. I understand that. But God answered my prayers because I was had no unfinished business with my mother when she left. My middle son, my wild child, got the discipline he needed to be 18. And he's now in the Marines. Talk about discipline. My youngest son went away for 2 years and it didn't work out. Huh? He's almost 21 years old, and I'm telling him at dinner, I can't get him to move out. I fell in love. I fell in, you know, fall in and out of love like mud puddles. But I did fall in love with this guy, and it was after I'd been alone for a very long time. And I was just crazy about him. And we were together for about 2 years. And it was really a good thing. We did the AA thing. And then we went out to the powwow. And while we were out the powwow, in fact, Bob met him. We were out here in Las Vegas once. When we were out the powwow, he's playing golf. And he's getting sick all the time. And we think it's just the heat. And we take him back home. But it continues. And he's starting to lose weight and starting to lose weight. And I'm being the good Al-Anon. I am a recovering member of Al-Anon some days. Being detached, minding my own business, calling my sponsor, saying, he's sick, he's sick, he's sick. And finally, I looked at him one day, and I said, you do whatever you want to do. I'm going to work. And he called me that day, and he'd hit a bottom with this deal. Like he said it felt like the same bottom he hit with alcohol, and he'd made himself a deal. If he couldn't keep a banana down that morning, he'd go to the doctor. And that morning, he couldn't keep a banana down. And he went to the doctor, and, oh, it's gallbladder. Oh, it's gallbladder. Don't worry, it's gallbladder. It was not gallbladder. It was stomach cancer. And he was very young, and I thought, oh, great, he's young, it'll be fine. And they said, there is no cure, and our hopes are to give him 5 years survival rate with this kind of stomach cancer. And it's like being hit with a Mack truck. Now, I'm the kind of person, you knock me down with news like that, and you tell me there's no cure, I will get up fighting and clawing. You don't tell me there's no cure. You don't knock me down. And I went out to look for a cure. Did a lot of research, got into a lot of hocus pocus, went to a lot of meetings, had my girls calling me all the time. If your sponsor is having trouble in her life and she asks you to call her, They wanted to stop calling me. Oh, you've got too much on your plate. And I looked at him and said, no, I need you more now than I have ever needed you. And they continued to call me. And that's how I stayed plugged into Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the end, the last 3 weeks of his life, he was in the hospital hooked up to morphine pumps. And there's nothing more terrifying than watching a recovering alcoholic be on pain meds, no matter how much they need them. And by the time that he died, you know, I would pray with him, and we'd just say the third step prayer, and we'd talk about healing. And I was trying to heal him, And I would tell him, I don't know whether it's going to be physical healing or spiritual healing, but I'm sure that God is here, and this is all about healing. And I would go out on our deck in the middle of the night, and I would cry a thousand tears. And I would look at that old sky, and I'd say, God, where are you? Where are you? And if I could ever get quiet enough on the inside, the answer was always the same. I'm here. I'm here. And the last 3 weeks of his life, I surrendered. I had to surrender one more time. And by that time he left, I had let him go in my heart. And it was a good deal. But see, I'm all about you. Let me focus on you. And all I wanted to do was God to make him better. And I had this woman get in my face with her finger. And I'm not generally the kind of person that you do that with. But she gets in my face with her finger. And she says, you just don't get it, do you? And I said, get what? And she says, it is not about his healing. It is about yours. I stand today, and I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did not have to take a drink one day at a time. I looked at my partner the other day and told him, put your face where your mouth is. I have to go back and make amends to him today. His spiritual program is none of my business. And I need to put my faith where my mouth is. I need to suit up and show up at these meetings. I need to focus on the women that I can help and leave those alone that I can't. I need to work my own program and not his. I need to be with you over and over and over and over again. I like to close my talk with a little Persian poetry. I keep saying I'll change, but it's my favorite thing. This is non-conference approved poetry. And it says, I slept and I dreamt that life was joy. I awoke and I found that life was service. I took action and I found that service was joy. And thanks to you, God, and strong sponsorship, I have known great joy. Thank you.